The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
The first complete scientific study of Stonehenge's large stones has revealed some information about why their material resists damage due to weather. Researchers recently described a series of examinations that gave a look inside one of Stonehenge's 52 large stones, known as sarsens. The researchers studied a core sample taken from one of the sarsens, called Stone 58, during repair work in the 1950s. It was kept by its owner in the United States for many years before being returned to Britain for research in 2018. The examination gave information about Stone 58's inside structure. The sarsens are made of stone called silcrete. This silcrete is made of very small pieces of quartz, held tightly together by quartz crystals. Quartz resists damage even when exposed to wind and weather. David Nash of the University of Brighton led the study that appeared in the journal PLOS ONE. Nash said the sarsen's inside structure explains the stone's resistance to weathering and why it made an ideal material for monument building. In a remarkable act of engineering, the sarsens were put up in Wiltshire, England, around 2500 BC. Stone 58, one of the very large sarsens at Stonehenge's center, stands about 7 meters tall, with another 2 meters underground. The core sample is a rod of stone, about 2.5 centimeters in diameter and roughly a meter long. Its color is brighter than the pale gray outside of the sarsens, which have been exposed to the weather for thousands of years. The sample had been given to a man named Robert Phillips. Phillips worked for a company that was involved in Stonehenge repair work. He took it with him with permission when he moved to the United States in 1977. Phillips decided to return it to Britain for research in 2018. He died in 2020. Nash said getting the sample from Stone 58 was very important for the research. All the previous work on sarsens at Stonehenge involved samples either excavated from the site or knocked off from random stones, he said. Random is a term that means in a way that does not follow a plan or pattern. The researchers used CT scanning, X-rays, microscopes, and various special methods to study very small pieces of the core sample. Such testing is not permitted for stones at Stonehenge itself. This small sample is now probably the most analyzed piece of stone other than moonrock, Nash said. Analyze means to carefully study. It remains unclear when the rock was formed. However, The researchers found that some sand pieces dated from as long as 1 billion to 1.6 billion years ago. Nash led research published last year involving the same core sample. That research showed that 50 of the 52 sarsens share a common origin about 25 kilometers from Stonehenge. Stonehenge's builders may have either pulled or moved the huge stones on circular objects known as rollers. Nash said there are still many open questions about Stonehenge. He added, "It's a site that is still rich with possibilities for doing more research." I'm John Russell.
Recently announced plans to use a tool designed to identify known child sexual images on iPhones. The decision was praised by child protection groups, but some privacy activists and security researchers have raised concerns. They warn that the system could be misused to search for other kinds of information or be used by governments to watch citizens. Apple says the tool, called Neural Hash, will scan all images kept on the device that are sent to iCloud, the company's online storage system. iPhone users can choose in their settings whether to send photos to iCloud or have them remain on the device. If the images are not sent to iCloud, Apple says they will not be scanned by the new tool. The system searches for photos included in a database of known child sexual abuse images collected by law enforcement. Apple's scanning system will change the images into a hash. This is a numerical piece of data that can identify the images but cannot be used to recreate them. This hash will be uploaded and compared against the law enforcement image database. If the system matches an image with one in the database, it will be examined by a human. If the person confirms the image as a match, the device user's account will be locked and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children will be contacted. The system is designed to only identify images already included in the existing database. Apple says parents taking innocent photos of unclothed children need not worry about such images being identified. Some security researchers have criticized the way Neural Hash sees the images and say the system could be used for dangerous purposes. Matthew Green is a top cryptography researcher at Johns Hopkins University. He told the Associated Press that he fears the system could be used to accuse innocent people. It could send users images that seem harmless, but that the system would report as child sexual material. Green said researchers have been able to easily fool similar systems in the past. Another possible abuse could be a government seeking to watch dissidents or protesters. What happens when the Chinese government says, "Here is a list of files that we want you to scan for," Green asked. Does Apple say no? I hope they say no, but their technology won't say no. In an online explanation of its system, Apple said it will refuse any such government demands. Apple has been under pressure from governments and law enforcement to permit increased observation of data that it encrypts on its devices. The company said its new tool was designed to operate with user privacy in mind. It also claimed the system was built to reduce the chance of misidentification to 1 in 1 trillion each year. However, some privacy researchers said the system represents a clear change for a company that has been praised for its leadership on privacy and security. In a joint statement, India McKinney and Erica Portnoy of the Electronic Frontier Foundation warned that Apple's new tool opens a back door to your private life. The two noted that it may be impossible for outside researchers to confirm whether Apple is operating the system as promised. Apple's system was also criticized by former U.S. National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. Snowden lives in exile because he is wanted in the U.S. on spying charges linked to his release of information on secret government programs for gathering intelligence. He tweeted that with the new tool, Apple was offering mass surveillance to the entire world. Snowden added, "Make no mistake, if they can scan for kiddie porn today, they can scan for anything tomorrow." Separately, Apple announced it was adding new tools to warn children and parents when sexually explicit images are received or sent. This system is designed to identify and blur such images and warn children and parents about the content. Apple says the tool will only work for messages in child accounts registered in the company's family sharing system. Apple said the changes will come out later this year with new releases of its device operating systems. I'm Brian Lynn.
Help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Thank you. VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document had established a loose union of the 13 states with a weak central government. But instead of amending the Articles, the delegates at the convention wrote a completely new constitution. As we heard last time, one of the issues they discussed was slavery. The existence of slavery affected decisions like how to count the national population. It also affected the powers proposed for Congress. The delegates at the convention accepted several political compromises on the issue of slavery. One compromise was the three-fifths rule. The population would be counted every 10 years to decide how many members each state would have in the House of Representatives in Congress. With the three-fifths rule, the delegates agreed that every five slaves would be counted as three people. Another compromise would allow states to import slaves until the year 1808. After that, no new slaves would be brought into the country. Many of the delegates in Philadelphia did not like these compromises, but they knew the compromises would keep the southern states, where slavery was most widespread, from leaving the convention. After all the debates, bitter arguments, and compromises, the delegates were nearing the end of their work. 4 months had passed since the convention began. The weather had been hot. Emotions had been hot, too, but that was expected. After all, the men in Philadelphia, and the delegates were all men, were deciding the future of their country. Early in September, the convention appointed five delegates to a committee of style. It was their job to write the document containing all the decisions made at the convention. The chairman of the committee was William Samuel Johnson of Connecticut. The other members were Alexander Hamilton of New York, Governor Morris of Pennsylvania, Rufus King of Massachusetts, and James Madison of Virginia. Of these five men, Governor Morris was known for the beauty of his language. So Johnson asked him to write the Constitution. Here in Washington, visitors to the National Archives can read an original copy of the United States Constitution. Leanne Potter at the National Archives says visitors are often surprised that the document is only 4 pages long.
The irony is that the pages are actually nearly 3 feet long and about 2 feet wide. They're written on parchment. In other words, they're written on animal skin using an iron gall ink. And this particular document was created in September of 1787.
The convention approved 23 articles for the Constitution. Governor Morris rewrote them in simpler form, so there were just 7.
The document itself is divided by article, and each article focuses on a different aspect of the American government.
Article 1 describes the powers of the Congress. It explains how to count the population for purposes of representation. and it states who can become senators or representatives and how long they can serve. Article 2 describes the powers of the president. It explains the requirements for the office and how the president is to be elected. Article 3 describes the powers of the federal judiciary, which includes the Supreme Court and all of the district and circuit courts. Leanne Potter at the National Archives explains.
That part of our government makes sure that the laws that the legislative branch creates and are being enforced by the executive branch are in fact constitutional. In other words, that the laws they create are legal themselves.
The first three articles provide a system of checks and balances. The purpose is to prevent any of the three branches of government, legislative, executive, or judicial, from becoming too powerful. Article 4 explains the rights and duties of the states under the new central government. Article 5 provides a system for amending the Constitution. Article 6 declares the Constitution to be the highest law of the land. And Article 7 simply says the Constitution will be established when 9 states approve it. The members of the convention wrote a preamble for the Constitution. It began, "We, the undersigned delegates of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and so on," it listed all 13 states by name. The Committee of Style did not think it was a good idea to list each state. After all, Rhode Island never sent a delegate to Philadelphia. And no one knew for sure if every state would approve the Constitution. So Gouverneur Morris wrote instead, "We, the people of the United States of America." Those simple words solved the problem. But they caused angry debate during the fight to approve the Constitution. They made clear that the power of the central government came not from the states, but directly from the citizens of the nation. Modern-day Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas came from a family descended from slaves. He grew up in the southern state of Georgia. Justice Thomas recalled having to memorize the opening statement to the Constitution when he was a child.
I always think it's so fascinating to think of these black kids in the segregated school in Savannah reciting the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. What do we believe? I mean, everything so obviously in front of you is wrong. You can't go to the public library. You can't live in certain neighborhoods. You can't go to certain schools. But despite all of that, you lived in an environment of people who said it was still our birthright to be included.
The rest of the preamble states why the Constitution was written. In order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The next step was to sign the document. On September 17th, the delegates gathered for the last time. One might think all of their business finally was done. But Nathaniel Gorham of Massachusetts rose to speak. "If it was not too late," he said, "he would like to make a change." Instead of electing one representative for every 40,000 people, as agreed, he suggested changing the number to 30,000. Gorham's proposal could have caused a bitter argument. Then, suddenly, George Washington, the president of the convention, stood up. The delegates were surprised. He had said little all summer. Now George Washington rose to express his support for the proposed change. He said it would guarantee a greater voice in the government for the people of the nation. Every delegate agreed to the change, which would mean a larger number of representatives in Congress. Finally, it was time to sign the Constitution. It was also the last chance to speak against it. Many delegates stated their objections to different parts of the document. In the end, most of the delegates declared that for the good of the nation, they would sign it. Several, however, refused to put their name on the Constitution. Edmund Randolph of Virginia and Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts said they could not sign the document. They believed it would not be approved by the states. And that, Gerry said, would lead to civil war. George Mason of Virginia also refused to sign. He had several reasons, but his first objection was that the document did not guarantee enough liberties. There is no declaration of any kind for preserving the liberty of the press, or the trial by jury in civil causes, nor against the danger of standing armies in time of peace. Mason wanted to add a declaration of rights. Randolph, Gerry, and Mason were the only delegates present in Philadelphia who did not sign the Constitution. Four other delegates who opposed it went home before the signing. So did nine delegates who supported the Constitution but went home early. Few of the delegates in Philadelphia could feel sure that enough states would approve the Constitution to make it the law of the land. As several of them said later, they wrote it the best they could. Without it, the young nation would break apart before it even had a chance to succeed. If future generations did not like the Constitution, it offered ways for them to change it. Here is George Washington, played by an actor.
I'm a practical man. I hope for the best, but I plan for the worst. And that's what this document does.
A record of the convention said that as the last delegates were signing the Constitution, Benjamin Franklin looked toward the president's chair. There was a sun painted on the back of the chair at the top. Franklin observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult to make a rising sun look different from a setting sun. Franklin said he had looked often at the sun on the chair during the convention without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now, at length, he said, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.